listening, Michelle from San Diego.
Hi, guys. I'm Michelle. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Michelle. Crazy about cocaine. And glad to be here tonight. And I want to welcome all the newcomers. Because you know what? This is a place you want to be, though it may not seem like it at the moment. I have found a neutrality here, and a peace here, and a joy here that cannot compare to the days that I was out there drinking and using. Honestly, and you couldn't have told me that the first night I walked in here. And happy birthday to the birthday people and the little baby that's inside the birthday girl. Happy birthday. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now for me. Because when I first walked into these rooms, it was relating to people that I heard at this podium that helped me stay here one day at a time. And for me, you know, I grew up, I was born in Modesto, California. I don't know if you know where that is. Ooh, gnarly. Home of Gala Wine and American Graffiti. And I didn't live very long there before we moved to Southern California. And when I was a couple, actually less than a year old, unbeknownst to me at the time, my mother was divorced, but she remarried before I even had knowledge of it. So the man that I knew to be my father raised me from birth until about 12 years old. But during that time growing up, I just intuitively knew somehow that things were different for me. Without really being told, I knew that my family situation was different. And that was sort of a theme, the thread, the fabric of my life that would really carry on through my drinking until I got sober. And what happened was my parents divorced when I was 12. And so my father, who I knew to be my father, moved to New York, and I was left with my mother. And when I was 16, I wanted my driver's license, as every 16-year-old does. And I asked my mother for my birth certificate, and she told me to use my baptismal certificate. It's like, Ma, nobody takes their baptismal certificate to the DMV. You know, so she left for the day, and she had this shoebox with all of her important documents in it. And I got into the shoebox, and it just confirmed for me what I didn't know, that piece that I felt so apart from, that the name that was on my birth certificate was not the name I'd been using in school. It was not the name that was on my Social Security card. I guess back in 1959, you could do anything you wanted. You didn't need a whole lot of documentation to change somebody's name. So, you know, that threw me. I wouldn't say it threw me because I was already thrown. I was already not feeling like I belonged. And it just validated for me that somehow I was different. And that carried on for me. So then she remarried again, and my father and my stepfather sort of, they were working for the same company. So it was very confusing. My adolescence was very confusing. And then I went, you know, that Bob Seger song, Little Too Tall, Could Have Used a Few Pounds. That was me in high school, about the same height I am now, alarmingly thin and very self-conscious. So when I finally picked up a drink, oh my gosh, it was so much better. It was just so much better. I had an ease and a comfort about me that would carry me through social situations, that would give me the courage that I couldn't muster up on my own. And I hit it hard. When I started to drink, I don't think I've ever had one drink in my entire life. When I started to drink, I drank until I could drink no more. And then eventually what happened for me was the drinking led to the drugging, and the drugging escalated everything else. But I was always, my friends could seem to stop. But I was the one that was at the drug dealer's door at 2 in the morning, let me in. I could not stop. I could not stop. And I tried all of the things that we read about tonight in More About Alcoholism. Just Tuesdays and Thursdays, like the Crosby, Nils, and Stash. You know, I mean, I just had all these great ideas of how I was going to moderate my drinking, and it just never worked. And I was one of those that, for whatever reason, I never really got into a lot of trouble. which didn't really help me because it kept my alcoholism going, because I wasn't arrested, because I didn't get a DUI. I mean, I drove so many times under the influence of alcohol. It is really only by God's grace that I didn't hurt myself or others. And I wish you would have put me in a hospital so I could have blamed you for putting me in the hospital and, you know, hopefully gotten sober. But none of those things happened, so I really had to take that first step myself. I had to get to that place that I was powerless over alcohol, that I could admit to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. So what happened for me was I continued to drink and use. I was in the garment industry downtown in the 80s, and it was a really good time. It was a good time to be in the garment industry. There was a lot of money available. There was a lot of partying available. It was a fast-paced industry, and I liked it. And it got to be, I wasn't happy, though. You know how that, you're doing the deal, but I wasn't happy. And my mother, you know, insisted that I go see this psychologist because she was unable to be, you know, to set aside her feelings. So I agreed to go to the psychologist, and everybody that I knew said, just whatever you do, don't tell her that you drink. I'm like, okay, I can do that. So I went to her and I just lied. I lied and lied and lied. I told her I took hot baths to calm me down. And, you know, this went on for months. And so finally she said to me, you know, I'd really like you to check out a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, what? You know, and... But I had met this, I knew this really cute guy that had gotten sober, and he was a bartender. So I thought, I'll call Michael T. And that was the only reason that I agreed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I picked up the phone, called Michael T. And, you know, he was a little surprised to hear from me, and even more surprised to hear that I wanted to go to an AA meeting. And he said, great, there's a great meeting Friday night. Friday night? Like, how about Monday morning, you know? Oh, freaking Friday night. But I said, okay, whatever. So I went to this meeting. It was in Brentwood, California. It was a big Friday night meeting. And I got there essentially thinking I was going on a date. Dressed for a date, looked forward to the date, got to the meeting, and he promptly turned me over to the women in the room. Like, what is going on here? So... You know, I'm one of newcomers. My heart goes out to you because it's such a tough, awkward place to be in. I'm reading the literature. I don't know what to do. I'm a fish out of water. And as I go to get into my seat, I crawl over my high school boyfriend. And he's like, Michelle? And I'm like, Danny? So I sit down at this meeting, and this gal, Yvonne, I remember it so vividly. She was telling her story, and she was talking about how her boyfriend would spell out her name in Quaaludes. And she had 8 letters in her name, and I had 8 letters in my name, and I'm thinking, Michelle and Quaaludes. You know, I was just, I was enthralled. So I made it through the meeting, and at the break, Danny comes up to me, and he says, so, you know, how long are you sober? I go, I'm not. He goes, well, keep coming back. So, okay. So I kept coming back. I would go to the meetings to appease the therapist, and I would drink and drug in between meetings. And I, you know, that's the best I could do. That's the best I could do. And along about just a little before Christmas, I was getting ready to go to a meeting, and I was setting up the party afterwards with my girlfriend. And I went to the meeting, and I got up to the podium to share about some nonsense. You know, they're about ready to get the hook out, and I didn't have a sponsor, but I had a therapist, and I left the meeting, and Danny was at the meeting that night, and I left the meeting and went home, put on my black leather skirt, and we went out into the night and got loaded until we decided we really just wanted to get comfortable, go home and get really loaded, but I was smoking cigarettes at the time, so I needed a pack of cigarettes, so we stop at the local Lucky Market where Danny works. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I've been at the podium like 6 hours prior. And he takes one look at me, and he goes, you're jonesing. And I go, yeah. And he says, I get off work at 5 a.m. I'll see you then. I'm like, holy cow. So we go back to my apartment. I tell my girlfriend, I better just snort coke and drink tea because Danny's coming over. So that was my plan. So So Danny comes over. I call him one time, you know, are you coming? He goes, I told you I'll be there at 5 a.m. 5 a.m., this guy shows up at my apartment with his big book, and we're sitting at the round table in my kitchen, and he's trying to tell me how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is working for him. And I can't stand anymore. You don't mind, do you? You know, and I was so, I look back on it now, and, you know, God bless this man. So I decided that I wanted him to kiss me. So I climbed onto his lap, and he said, I'm not going to kiss you. You've been drinking. It's like, wow, nobody had ever said that to me before. You know, so I sort of crawled back onto my seat and sat there, and he got up finally and said, look, I got to go, and went downstairs. He couldn't start his motorcycle, and I'm thinking he's coming back, and he didn't come back, and that was my moment of clarity. In my party dress, in my house, alone at 5 in the morning. It wasn't that period of time when I was, you know, smoking cocaine and I had lower companions in my apartment and I was freaking out. It wasn't the dramatic moments that I put myself in harm's way. It was just that moment at 5 o'clock in my apartment where I went, what the heck are you doing? What's going on with you? And so I got up the next morning and I decided that I would go back and check out this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was like one of those rooms that they had meetings in all the time. And I went back and I sat there in the meeting and just cried, man. I just cried. And the next day I went back to that room and Danny Weber was coming up the stairs just as I was coming up. And he said, you counting days yet? I said, yeah, you know, I guess I am. And that was December the 11th, 1988. That was 26 years ago. I was 29 years old, and I hadn't planned on getting sober. I didn't want to get sober, but I was tired. I was tired of being miserable. I was tired of not belonging. And for me, what happened that first year is that I found a family. I found people that loved me, that I could love, like Kyle, who I don't think is here at the moment, was talking about, that people would show up for me, and I could show up for them. And it was beyond what I could even, if you've experienced it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't experienced it yet, stick around. Stick around. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. You can, you know, you can't choose your family, but you can choose this family. We choose to show up for one another. And I'm telling you guys, that first year was rough. I did not have a good time. I thought One Day at a Time was that TV show with Mackenzie Phillips. You know, that when I saw that bumper sticker, I was mad. It's like, One Day at a Time? What the heck? Why would I do anything for One Day at a Time? I just was angry. I was angry, mostly because I hadn't done anything sober in the longest time. I was accustomed to starting late until dawn, and all of a sudden my days were free, and I didn't know how to operate. And this program gave me a blueprint for living that helped me understand what I do upon awakening, how I get through each day a moment at a time. How in the beginning it was just a matter of hanging on to you, so I didn't pick up that drink. And slowly, slowly, things started to fall into place for me. And it was my work, I'm like, I'm not getting it, I'm not getting it. They're like, you're getting it. Just, you know, just keep showing up. That's the best I could do. And for me, you know, I made it through that first year. I remember in Santa Monica, they used to have this huge New Year's Eve party. I mean, it was at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. There were just so many people there. And I decided to go to this party, and I walked in, and, you know, all these people are drinking Coca-Cola and blowing horns, and I'm going to throw up. I'm like, this is awful. What are they so flippin' happy about? And they're my favorite dive bar, Shea J's, if anybody knows Santa Monica. It was across the street, and I remember Danny, I was there with Danny, God bless Danny, is all I can say, and he just opened the door for me, and he said, go ahead, and, you know, I had to stop and ponder for a minute, which way am I going to go here? Am I going to go back to what I knew, that I was miserable, that I had that aching sense in me of who am I and where do I belong? Or I'm going to jump into the water with these crazy 1,000 people drinking Coca-Cola and blowing their horns. And, you know, just for a minute, surrender. Because this road has been about a surrender. In the beginning, I didn't know what I was surrendering to. But I saw it working with other people. And that's what I'll tell you. It's a program of attraction. So find something that you can relate to here and hang on to it. You know, I saw people that I drank and used with in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Friday night. Nobody else could have told me but the people that I used to be drinking and using with. Because for whatever reason, they were choosing sobriety. And that spoke to me. And you know what? I believe that where God leads, He proceeds. And I believe that He was preparing me every step of the way for the plans that He had for me. And for me, you know, I was 29 years old. I was on the brink of my 30th birthday. I had really big plans for my 30th birthday. None of that went as planned. Back then, they had a Sober Club Med. So I ended up going on a Sober Club Med, and that was a beautiful thing because they had meetings morning, noon, and night, and I was surrounded by my family, and so that was my celebration. Early into my sobriety, like the first 2 years of my sobriety, I had one of those boy meets girl on AA campus experiences, and I met my husband there in that Friday night meeting in the rooms of AA. And we went on this journey together. We had 3 beautiful children. And I was able to raise them sober. Because you know what? I would have been at Shay J's with my kids in the car. There's not a doubt in my mind about that. I would have put the napkin on the porthole. I would have locked them in the car. And I would have stayed in there until I was done. And not even thought twice about it. But instead, I had an opportunity to be present for my kids, to give my children the gift of seeing them, the gift that I didn't get through no fault of anybody's. You know, my mother did the best she could, but I was able to just show up for my kids imperfectly. I had 3 children, 4 and under. That's a tall order. But we set out to raise our kids in a sober environment, and it was a beautiful thing, and I took them to meetings when it was appropriate, and they learned the principles of the program, because that's all I knew then. I knew what you taught me here. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that had made my life unmanageable. I knew that my thinking was insane, but slowly, by working this program, I was returning to sanity. And I had made that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him each moment of the way, because that understanding is relational. How I understood God in my first year of sobriety and who I know Him to be in my life today is different. But I was doing it one day at a time, and I knew that me running the show then was not working. So I was willing to suit up and to show up and to take direction. And I did my inventory, and I made my amends, and I just took it a day at a time. We moved from L.A. to San Diego. I was pregnant with my youngest, and it was 1997. And one more time, I was grateful for this program because I was in a new city. I knew no one. I had a husband who we moved to San Diego so he could work here, and then his business moved him to Simi Valley. So he was gone most of the time, and I had 3 children under 4. And if it wasn't for the women's meetings, we had a mother's meeting on Monday morning in Solana Beach, and I would go there with my kids, and they would just let me cry or whatever I needed to do, and the kids weren't a nuisance, and it was one more time a family. And you guys supported me. And I, you know, I continued to do this through all the early years of my sobriety, and things went well for a while. You know, as any young family, it's not easy raising children. Small kids, small problems. Big kids, I hate to tell you, big problems. But, you know, I got the support that I needed here. And for me, about 10 years of sobriety, I had this nagging question. Who am I turning my will and my life over to? I knew it was a power greater than myself. I knew that it was God as I understood him, as I had understood him. But it wasn't enough for me. It just wasn't enough. As good as it got, I needed to know. I really needed to know. So for me, and this is my journey, and that's why I can just tell you my story, and hopefully that experience will help somebody else who's out there. I just set out on this quest to find out who I was turning my will and my life over to. And I wanted a big God. I got to tell you, I wanted a big God. I was not going to settle for anything less. And I took it to the mat. I wrestled with it. It didn't make me a lot of friends, I'll have to let you know, because people didn't really understand it. But there was a burning in my gut that I could not deny. And I found myself a living God that I could do business with. And I poured everything I had into that relationship. And I made it the most important thing in my life. And I got to tell you guys, it has been my everything. You know, it has been something that I would not forsake for the sake of drugs and alcohol. And I believe that my relationship, the book tells us that we are sober, our sobriety is contingent on our spiritual condition. And I believe that for a fact, because I had no idea what was coming down the pike for me. All I knew that I was putting one foot in front of another, and I was working with other women, and I was taking direction, and I was staying sober one day at a time, and I was finding out who God was for me. In 2010, everything turned around for me. The husband that I got sober with had 20 years, and he went out and drank and used again. And with that, had a vicious gambling addiction. And everything that I knew completely turned upside down. And I didn't have a category for it, because I had never seen this man not sober. I had fantasized about it. I thought, wouldn't that have been great? We could have, like, drank together and partied together and snorted coke. Oh, my goodness. No, let me tell you, it's not great. Alcoholism in real time is ugly. It's ugly. And I got an opportunity to see the disease in action from sober eyes. And what I mean about God, where he leads, he proceeds. That relationship that I had been building for the last 10 years was now the bedrock on which I was going to stay sober. And it was the faith that I had and the trust that I had that self-reliance was not going to get me through this storm. That I had to be God-reliant. That I had to trust him. That when the water isn't running, and I'm going next door, is your water turned off? They're what? You know, and when the children's bank accounts are being emptied, when the insanity is in full force, that I can say the serenity prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. I cannot change what's going on right now. The courage to change the things I can, to say no to the alcoholic when I need to protect myself when I want to be codependent, and the wisdom, God, to know the difference. What do I do? When do I be quiet? When do I move forward? And I'm telling you, God is faithful. He was with me every step of the way. And I got through it, and I didn't get through it alone. I got through it because I had relationships that I had built in these rooms and women that stood by me, and I had enough women that I could wear one out, and there was another one there to take her place while she tanked up. Because it's like a storm. You know, it is a storm, and no human power can relieve us from the insanity, whether you're on one side of the coin or the other. And I'm telling you, the strength that I got from the work that I've done here, and it was the same period of time that I was doing an in-depth run through the steps, spending 6 months of my life going through the steps, turning statements into questions, and being willing to have an open mind for a new experience. Because I had to ask myself during that time, what if I'm not an alcoholic? What if? And so this work and this fellowship and the willingness to venture out into faith, which is trusting the unseen. And that's tough. That is the hardest part, because I want a guarantee. I want a guarantee. That's what I wanted when I got here. That's actually why I stayed here, because I saw you as my guarantee. I saw you as drinking and using with me, and I saw you here sober, so that was good enough for me, but you had to go first. I wasn't going first. And through this process, I was able to just take it one day at a time. And the husband became a husband. And I, you know, and that was so hard for me. That was so hard for me. Because of the dream. Because I was that little girl whose dad left. I had my three dads. I had three different fathers. This was not the story that I wanted for my three children. And so I had to let go of that. And I had compassion, because I'm of the same tribe as this person. He was my brother in sobriety. And I had to watch him struggle. But God can do immeasurably more than I could ever hope for or imagine. And that is the God's truth. Because through that trial and through my willingness to seek his face, not his hands necessarily, but his face, and get the comfort that only he can give, that peace that passes all understanding, that neutrality that I so desperately sought out when I wanted to drink, when I was drinking and using, that was available to me on a daily basis. And I got through it. I got through it. It is now 2015. It takes a minute. You know, it takes a minute. When I was a year sober, I wanted to be 5 years sober, and then I wanted to be 10, and I was wishing my life and my sobriety away. And when this trial started, I wanted it over in 2 weeks' time. And, you know, a good friend would just say, you know what, Michelle, it takes a minute. And it did. But God is good. And life is hard. And people are broken. And we have self-will. And for us, we have a disease. And self-will coupled with will run riot and a disease, an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind, is a tough road to go. But you know what? That husband will have a year sobriety next month. My children have been able to see what it looks like to be sober and then to be in addiction. Because I tell them, you guys are you're teed up. You're genetically teed up. You have to be careful. You have to be mindful. And that's that is something that they're going to have to figure out on their own. And that's where I need God one more time, because I have to release them. I have to know that if this God has got a plan for my life, then he certainly has a plan for my children's lives. And because I love them so much, I want to manage and control it. But it doesn't work that way. And every time I hang on a little tighter, things get a little crazier. And I have to remind myself one more time, it's not my show, it's his show. History is his story. So I just want to be a willing participant. And I'm so grateful to be able to share a little bit about what it's been like for me and what it's like now. And I hope there aren't too many women in the room tonight, but sisters, I'm telling you, this has been an immeasurable gift in my life. And I've found a freedom and a happiness here, and a sisterhood here, and a peace here, and a joy here that you couldn't have told me about when I first walked through these doors. But if you stick around and you become willing to do the work, I promise you that the gifts are here for your taking. So I just want to leave you guys with one thing that has meant a lot to me in this journey, and that there is no high like the Most High.